Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover.
The difficulty, I think, that a lot of the Never Trump Republicans have is this accusation that somehow they're not sincere in their beliefs or that they've become liberals or they've become left-wingers. I think the problem is now that there is no place for these people. So at this point, I'm in a wait-and-see mode. I think the Republicans have permanently eliminated themselves from credibility to govern from...
Permanently.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, yes. I think you can't be willing to sacrifice core American values for the sake of a tax cut and be deemed to be worthy of trust going forward.
Today's guest, Washington Post right turn blogger Jennifer Rubin. When I was covering the Obama White House, Rubin was all over them all the time, particularly on foreign policy, and hear them griping about her constantly. It's been a big couple of years. Now Rubin is one of the most reliable critics of the Trump White House and of Donald Trump and of the Republican Party. But she says she's still a conservative, that it's the party who left her. She even started by writing a breakup note to the Republican Party during the 2016 election. They haven't reconciled since, and sounds like that's not happening anytime soon based on our conversation. She's hoping for a new party or for the Democrats to become more like her. I'd say both seem pretty unlikely. It's been a very weird experience for her, and one that I wanted to get into. Her thoughts on what the Republican Party is at this point, what the future of Republican politics is, and what the future of conservative politics is. We also had a very interesting discussion about how millennial politics is being shaped by what's going on. So we got into all of that, plus how a labor lawyer who went to Berkeley turned into a conservative columnist for The Washington Post. Remember to subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts or however you're listening. Episodes coming up, 27-year-old Stockton, California Mayor Michael Tubbs, and late-night host Seth Meyers, and many, many more. Don't miss an episode. Really exciting stuff continuing to come. And email me your thoughts at isaacatpolitico.com. Follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover. And now, my conversation with Jennifer Rubin. You went to law school.
I did.
And then you went into journalism. My mother really wanted me to be a lawyer and did not like that I went into journalism. So what went wrong for you that you did the thing that my mother was deathly afraid of, although you got the JD along the way?
I do not recommend this as a career plan for any other human being. I went to law school. I practiced law for about 20 years in Los Angeles. And quite frankly, for strictly personal reasons, I was working a long day and my husband was working a long day. We had two young kids. I felt like there had to be something better than this. So we decided to make a life-changing decision and we moved cross-country. My husband continued to work in the same field that he is in. And for a number of months, I was enjoying being a stay-at-home mom and volunteering and doing a lot of other things. And then purely as a lark, I wrote a piece, ironically, about Mitt Romney. And because I didn't know any better, sent it in to the Weekly Standard.
Which you were just a subscriber to?
Or? Oh, yes, exactly. I was always interested in news, always followed closely a number of publications. And Matt Continetti, he will be responsible, and that may be a good thing or a bad thing, said, hey, yeah, this is pretty good. And I thought to myself, that's it?
You just sent it into the general inbox?
I think I called Matt, as I recall, mm-hmm. and kind of described what it was. And he said, sure, send it in. I'm sure thinking this would be one of the many ridiculous things he understandably.
But you didn't know him beforehand.
I didn't. I had no relation.
What kind of law did you do?
I was a labor lawyer. So it was both union law as well as employment discrimination, terminations, and the rest.
I think a lot of people would expect that a labor lawyer would be a little bit further left on the spectrum than you are.
I was a management labor lawyer. You have to understand there are two sides to this. So I generally represented the employers. And I did work for the Hollywood studios, though. So it was a relatively liberal environment.
So you were with like the like Best Boy Union or the Grips or like that kind of stuff?
We would negotiate with those people. That's correct. We had these multi-employer negotiations. And years later, it has informed a lot of my thinking about negotiations, about things like groupthink and, you know, the effort that is only human nature, which is to delay till the very last moment, and kind of group dynamics. So it comes in handy. And as I say very often, my legal background completely informs my writing and I think my skill set. You learn to write and read fast. You learn to ask good questions. You learn to make an argument. And of course, a lot of politics, particularly these days, has a legal bent to it. So I can still read my way through a Supreme Court decision and it's understand important. What it means and break it down. And particularly in the age of Trump, when the rule of law is such a big deal, that certainly has caught my attention. And I think
it seems like a good time to know a little bit about the law, although maybe more like criminal law than you did in terms of the things that are coming up. So you call up Matt Continente and say, you've got this piece, you send it in, he calls you back and says, this is
he says it's
terrible.
A little long. I think I sent him in, I don't know, 3,000 words.
That's a real editor. Yeah, that's the first thing an editor should say.
Yes, he says it's a little bit long, but I think there's about, 1,700 words in here that are very good. We'd like to use it. And I was stunned because somehow, coming from another profession, I thought there was some magic juice to journalism, that you had to have your journalism card and that you had to toil in the local police departments and courtroom coverage to get what you need to know. And it was sort of a revelation to me that knowing a lot about the law and knowing a fair amount at that time about politics and being able to read and write and interact with other human beings gets you about 80% of the way there. So
I think it's important that mentality of the way you thought it was maybe would have been true a little bit earlier out, but this was not all that long ago that you made this transition.
Correct.
Right? So
this was
2006, right?
Yeah, 2005-ish, yeah. I think. So yes, this could not have happened at another time. It couldn't have happened earlier and it couldn't have happened later. So I did catch the wave, as it were, when people were desperate for content. Mm-hmm. There were opportunities for people who hadn't been in journalism their entire lives. And we were just heading into what turned out to be one of the longest presidential election seasons on earth. I think it was like the beginning of 2006 when Mitt Romney decided he was running.
We're still in that one, aren't
we?
Yeah.
And so it just, the timing was right.
So the piece, the original piece here was about Mitt Romney, and was what about him?
It was looking at his record as governor. And this was one of the earlier pieces saying, hey, the guy who was governor sure as heck is not the guy who's running for president. And because I was so early in the cycle, this sort of came as a revelation, I guess, to some people. It later became the default, theory.
Certainly by the time that he was running again in 12.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. But I did what good journalists do, which is I called up people. I called up his former opponents in political races. I called up people.
But you were doing the job of being a reporter, even though you didn't know what you were talking about.
That's correct. Right? And when I would call people up, I would shout to my husband in the next room, what do I tell them I am? And he said, tell them you're an independent journalist. And I said, oh, that sounds good. I'm an independent journalist. Now, let me ask you this
question. I'm always struck by how sometimes when I call people, they will just start talking.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
It is.
Particularly about Mitt Romney, because the people that I was talking to, who included people in the pro-choice movement in Massachusetts, desperately wanted to tell their story because,
right,
of course,
abandoned by him.
And he did essentially a 180. So people really were anxious to talk. And to my benefit, they had some interesting things to say. And I was off to the races.
What makes you a conservative?
That's a great question. It has been hard for conservatives. And the definition of being a conservative has really come under assault. And you can ask 10 people and you get 10 definitions. I'll tell you what attracted me to conservatism and why I still consider myself to be a conservative. At the time that I grew up in the dim, dark past, we were still in the middle of the Cold War. My idol at that point was Jean Kilpatrick. I was very anti-communist. I thought America had to lead in the world. I thought America was a force for good. I thought confident leadership made the world a better place. And at the time, I think the Democrats were in the full throes of McGovernism, even though he had lost. So foreign policy always figured very prominently for me. But I think I had an inherent suspicion of large government. I believed in the free market. I believed in free trade. I believed in immigration. You're going to see the theme here. And then I thought that modest but active government was the way to go. Mm-hmm. And at that time, national health care was really not a burning issue. Environmentalism took the form of particle pollution as opposed to global warming.
Right.
So I felt comfortable enough within the Republican Party that I considered myself not a, quote, movement conservative, but comfortably within what was a party that at that point was perfectly happy to have a good contingent of moderate to moderate conservative
in the
people.
Tent because it was a big enough tent.
Correct. And because it adhered to certain principles that were consistent and that were appealing to a large segment of the population, like fiscal conservatism, which now is a hoot.
Did you vote for anybody who wasn't a Republican along the way?
Occasionally, I did vote for Dianne Feinstein. I thought she's still on the ballot, wouldn't you know?
There you go.
But primarily for Republicans. Yeah. And
so you're a Republican, right?
Yes, I absolutely was. And I also considered that conservatism, as opposed to Republicanism, and I think it's an important distinction, was really about a temperament as much as a substantive list of issues. It was a certain modesty in mm-hmm. approaching government. It was the understanding that human nature was not infinitely malleable. It was an understanding that the civil institutions of church, of family, of synagogue, local government were important, and that's where most of the good things in society happen. It was a certain humility about governance and a reliance on the structures of the Constitution mm-hmm. to keep central government from getting to be too powerful. And so in that vein, I was a conservative. And I think as I'm listening to myself describe that, you can understand why I don't think I have changed at all.
You feel like the party has left you.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think with very few exceptions, I am still the same conservative I was. I believe in the rule of law. I believe in free markets. I believe in American leadership in the world. I believe in the America as a creedal country. All men are created equal. Believe that generally, with some regulation, obviously, free markets work well. They bring people out of poverty. They give opportunity. And so those same beliefs, which I think attracted me to the conservative movement originally and kept me there for a very long time, are still what motivate me. The problem is I do not have a party now that the party has left.
Are there conservatives left in the Republican Party leadership?
It depends, I guess, on your definition of conservative.
On your definition of conservative.
Under my definition of conservative, well, I thought Paul Ryan sort of was, and maybe
you
he could give it up.
You thought he was before, or you thought he was over the last 2 years?
He was before he made his pact with the devil and decided to go into the Trump coalition, if you will. So it was people like that. I was a great admirer of Jack Kemp.
Jack Kemp hasn't been around in Republican leadership.
That's true, but it kept me going for a very long time. I'm an Arthur Brooks Republican. How's that?
I mean,
I'm an AEI Republican.
So is there anyone in the current Republican leadership that you would and we can use leadership somewhat broadly here? It doesn't need to just be Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and Donald Trump, though they are the three leaders. Is there anybody else that you see?
John Kasich. I mean, that's really the problem. Is that it's not just Donald Trump, and I have never bought into this notion that all the Republican Party has to do is throw out Donald Trump. It's an entire party and, frankly, a base that has become a font of know-nothingism, of nativism, of protectionism, and really of radicalism. These people want dramatic, huge changes that depart from the American experience, which is in no way or shape or form conservative. It is unconservative to want such radical changes. And so I am left adrift. And I have thought, well, in 2020, is there a possibility that I could vote for a Republican? The list is pretty short, like less than the fingers on one hand.
It's not going to be Donald Trump based on where you are.
Yeah.
We're doing a podcast, but I'm going to show you a picture and I'm going to show it to you and describe to you what I'm showing to you, which is this picture that President Trump tweeted the other day, which is he and the leaders of the House and Senate and the Republicans all with their thumbs up posing. It was after Ryan announced that he was retiring. What does that picture make you think of?
One of the problems with the Republican Party is it has become the caricature the left always said it was, the party of old white men. And that has become more so in the age of Donald Trump when he is actively courting and stoking white resentment when he is using immigration in a reprehensible fashion, and that is a dead end for the party. It's a dead end because it's immoral and anti-American to base an entire political movement on one racial group. And it's a dead end because that's not America. And it is becoming, every cliche in the book is true, it's becoming an even more diverse country. And it's one of the reasons why millennials, the largest generation, the most diverse generation, hate this president. Overwhelming numbers.
I mean, the numbers are, whatever you think of President Trump, whatever you think of millennial voters, what they think of President Trump seems pretty clear, not just from the polls, but when you see the turnout going on. It was 60-something percent in Alabama in the special election of people, I think it was under 35, voted for Doug Jones. It's just a massive – and the number of candidates who are running who are young, and it does seem like we will see those trends likely continue into the fall. And if the Democrats have a good year, it will have something to do with the fact that all these young people are voting and have been – turned on by maybe one cause or another cause, some by guns, some by climate, whatever it may be, but really just lit up against Trump in a way almost it might be as much, maybe even more, as they were lit up for Obama, the people who were young in 2008.
Absolutely. I think there are a few things to unwind there. One is that it matters greatly who is president and what the political environment is as you are coming of political age. When did I come of political age? As Ronald Reagan was entering the White House. And even though the party had stopped being that for decades, that was my conception of the Republican Party. And I hung on probably beyond the point at which that seems to be true.
Well, you and a lot of other Republicans.
Yes. So that you have a generation that now potentially knows nothing about the Republican Party other than the party of Trump.
Mm-hmm. Is it the party of Trump?
As far as it is now, yes, it is.
We were talking about Obama. Let's talk about your relationship with Obama. When he was president, you were one of the people that, and I can say this from having covered the Obama White House, drove them crazy. You were a pretty consistent critic of him. And I think they would have probably grouped you in the people that was like their most dismissive insult were, like, he used to say, if I say the sky is blue, they would say the sky is red. Or if I'm up, then if I say up, they say down. That's the way they processed a lot of what your attacks on him.
I'm not sure whether they viewed that across the board, but at least with respect to foreign policy,
certainly,
they were absolutely right. I thought his foreign policy, which ironically Trump seems to be mimicking in a number of fashions, was disastrous for America and disastrous for freedom around the world.
Can I read a quote to you?
Yes, sure.
I'm going to read a writer's words back to her. So always, right? This is, you were talking about where Obama was on the Ground Zero Mosque, which when I was thinking about this, it was only 2010. It feels about 3,000 years ago, where there was this question of whether to force it to relocate. It was a couple blocks from the World Trade Center site. And you wrote, he is entirely, and to many Americans, horridly, a creature of the left with little ability to make moral distinctions. It seems like a thread that carries through your thoughts on Obama.
Looking back on that, and you have me at a disadvantage because I have no idea what the context and the rest of that is, I would say this. He was a creature of the left. He was an academic member of the left.
Totally.
I think he would embrace that.
Yep.
I think
he would say that he is an academic, all this stuff, that to him it's just pragmatic thinking. And of course, like, this was one of the things that he would get frustrated about. He would say, I'm not an ideologue. I'm just looking at this. It's the only way to come
Which
to the conclusion.
Which is exactly what an ideologue
right.
would say.
Right. And people would say, like, well, yeah, like, he would say, like, take your politics out of it. He used to say that to Paul Ryan, and it would drive Paul Ryan crazy. Just take your politics out of it for a second. We can get to this. And Paul Ryan would say, basically, like, you take your politics out
yes.
of it. Right?
And hence the constructive relationship that those two had. I think I would say this, that he never appreciated that there was a moral argument on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly as you said, that a lot of American politics is about means, but a good deal of it is also about values. And as we've learned recently, if you don't understand where the other person is sitting and you choose to write them off, you're going to have problems. And I think rightly or wrongly, he viewed critics and the Republican Party as people who were not acting in good faith. He gave a number of speeches in which he said these people want dirty water and they don't want clean air and they want to take away your Social Security. And that was highly, highly objectionable to me, because I think we now see how that plays out when the shoe is on the other foot. The notion in a democracy that only you have the monopoly on truth and wisdom and that other arguments are illegitimate is the beginning of the end of decent democratic discussion, small d democratic discussion. So I would say that. And listen, I think many of the criticisms that I had about Obama's foreign policy are now being replayed within the prism of Donald Trump. There are an awful lot of Democrats now who are saying America has to lead in the world and America has to have a strong human rights policy and America has to stand up for NATO and America can't lead from behind. Yeah, I agree with that. So
you feel like you're the one who's been consistent.
Absolutely. and listen, I don't think, by the way, it's a requirement that you be consistent in different times under different situations. People are allowed to learn and people are allowed to evolve and people are allowed to shape their viewpoints to fit changed circumstances. But I do think the notion that the, quote, never Trumpers, of which I am a proud card-carrying member.
You broke up with the GOP in the spring of 2016.
That's right. I wrote a breakup letter, which got a lot of attention. But the difficulty, I think, that a lot of the never-Trump Republicans have is this accusation that somehow they're not sincere in their beliefs or that they've become liberals or they've become left-wingers. And at least the ones I know come at this from a conservative perspective. And if you read what I write carefully, you'll see that much of my criticism of Trump is from the right. Mm-hmm. I attack him on free trade. I attack him on immigration. These are free market principles. I attack him on lack of fidelity to the Constitution. I attack him on a misunderstanding of the origin of America, which is a creedal, not a racial or religious country. So I think the problem is now that there is no place for these people unless, and I have hope burning eternal in my soul, one of two things happens. Either a more modest center-right party comes along to fill in that huge gap.
New political party.
Yes, that would absorb center-right to center-left, of which I think there's much more agreement than people would normally assume. And the other is that the Democratic Party settled back much closer to the center than they've been. As to the latter, I don't see a lot of hope there, because that's not where their energy is. I think it will be lucky if they wind up to the right of Bernie Sanders for the country. So at this point, I'm in a wait and see mode. I think the Republicans have permanently eliminated themselves from credibility to govern from
permanently.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, yes. I think you can't be willing to sacrifice core American values for the sake of a tax cut and be deemed to be worthy of trust going forward.
Do you think that they have sacrificed the idea of fiscal responsibility? That was one of the critiques about the tax bill, that there's a lot of the deficits are going up. It's not paid for. It's a bill that you got to imagine if it had been brought forward by Democrats and like the exact same bill. I don't like to do the whataboutism argument, but I mean, it is a bill that is not fiscally conservative.
Exactly. And you can come up with a whole long list of other issues. You know, there was a time, perhaps a nanosecond, when the Republican Party wanted to be a party of reform. They were the party of welfare reform, which mm-hmm. was one of the more successful post-World War II innovations in government. And there was talk about bringing that sensibility to healthcare, to education, sort of across the board. Mm-hmm. And that vanished as soon as Donald Trump came upon the scene. And I think it's a loss for the country, because I don't think the choice for Americans should be Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders.
Do you think anything, when you reflect back on how you were a critic of Obama, critic of the way that he was going about things, is there anything that makes you, with how things have ended up, regret that the way you approached it? Or is it, I mean, you said the point earlier that like some of what he did seems to have helped lead us to this place.
I think the entire country, me included, has taken certain qualities in every single president who preceded Donald Trump for granted. Whatever Obama's faults were, he understood constitutional government. He was not a xenophobe. He understood that America has to be an inclusive place in the world. He did not demean the office of the presidency. He wasn't personally cruel. He wasn't vulgar. He acted like a president. There's no doubt about it that extreme polarization in large part paved the way for Donald Trump. And I think we all have to be a little self-critical looking back. I do not think, however, that Politico or Jennifer Rubin writing a harsh column on Israel policy did it. What I do think bears a lot of responsibility is the conservative media bubble that basically was content to feed nonsense, to feed propaganda, to feed white resentment to its base. And this goes from National Review to Rush Limbaugh to Sean Hannity. That there was
what about your old friends at the Weekly Standard and Commentary?
I think actually at those two publications, and you see it now in the Trump world, that they were a lot better than many of their compadres. I'm sure you can pull out instances in which they went too far. But I think particularly at Commentary, which is an intellectual magazine, you would see a certain sensibility that was very different. And you can see at Weekly Standard now, Bill Kristol is one of the leading never Trumpers. Yes. So I think they've held up pretty well, actually. But I do think that.
But the thing about Bill Kristol is, yes, you're right about that. But of course, he very proudly was the one who sort of helped make Sarah Palin a figure on the National Republican Party. And there, I think, is fairly a way to track a line. It's not a one line, but one of the things that led to that strain getting elevated in the Republican Party, which is the very Trumpy strain, is Palin, right?
To quote a famous movie line, nobody's perfect. listen, there's plenty of blame to go all around. I do think, though, that when for a decade or so you feed conservatives a lot of white grievance, a lot of resentment towards minorities, a lot of fantastical stuff, a sense of being betrayed, that that does pollute the political environment. And I don't think that the left had an equivalent, I will say.
No, they used to cry about it for so long. Oh, Air America, remember that?
Yeah, that's right. They didn't work.
The only thing that came out of Air America was Al Franken became a senator, and that, of course, didn't work out.
Right? Exactly.
Is it hard when you're talking to your conservative friends? They know where you stand on these issues. You're writing about it, talking about it on TV all the time.
Oh, it's been a really remarkable personal as well as intellectual journey. And yes, it's sort of turned my world upside down. There are certain conservatives and I who do not talk and do not get along. I'm regularly attacked by every one of these, right-wing publications.
Are there friends that you know? There are other.
In the sense that one is friends with work colleagues, mm-hmm. one is friendly with work colleagues. I do think that it's more than made up by the fact I have a lot of friends who are Democrats now. And I will say this, and I will confess that I too often bought into the conservative nostrum that Democrats were only about power. They didn't appreciate the rule of law. They were Marxists in some weird sense. And in fact, there are a lot of really sensible Democrats who believe in the rule of law, whose foreign policy isn't that far from where I am. And so in that sense, it's been a very interesting experience to really shed a lot of these partisan team notions about who's on your side and who do you interact with and who do you relate to. So I think the folks who continue to attack me and who think that the Never Trump people are evil or confused or some combination thereof, they're entitled to their views. But I got to say, from a personal standpoint, I sort of like the trade because now I have very smart conservative friends and colleagues and allies in some sense who I tremendously respect, who have come to these positions and stuck to these positions despite huge criticism and in some cases real personal and professional loss. And I also have...
Do you have any personal and professional loss?
I think personal loss would be true. I think
because of work, friends, so,
things like that. Yeah. Listen, no one thought this was a good, wise play to suddenly renounce the party that you had been supporting for a number of years. This was not
publicly, right?
Yeah, and publicly, this was not a smart move if you were trying to game it out. But by this,
are there people that you have retained friendships with who are Trump supporters who say like, hey, you're completely wrong about him and what's going on, but we can stay talking? Or is it just...
I'm thinking. And that's not meant to be a Jack Benny joke. I would say a few. And those would be, I think, the people who say, yeah, I don't like Trump for all the reasons you do, but at least we got tax.
Right.
You know, or at least we got,
yeah,
you know, the court.
Argument, right.
This is the but Gorsuch crowd.
Right.
I don't think that's a morally defensible position, but I think the people who hold it are sincere in that and that they don't wish America harm.
Foreign policy is where you are really well known for your thoughts on a lot of things. North Korea is what our big foreign policy issue, aside from Syria, I guess, or whatever else may flare up. I was pulling something from – this is also from 2010, I guess, same as the other one. So you were advocating an approach on North Korea. Then you said the Bush-Obama engagement hasn't been working. So what you said was we should step up our engagement with China. We should step up the military presence in the region and do something different.
Isn't that what Trump is doing?
No, he's threatening thermonuclear war. But
he is stepping up the engagement with China, and he's –
And
you know,
I have often observed that if you had the Trump administration without Trump, they would be doing a lot of sane things because – and I think there is a complete disconnect. You saw it in the hearings today with Mike Pompeo, mm-hmm. who's the nominee for Secretary of State, that there are many elements which are perfectly fine. One of the other things which I think would be an anathema to this administration would be to start doing what we did for Europe under communism and the Cubans under communism, to begin to see if we can get information at least into that country. The hurdles are immense, and I'm not sure, sitting from the vantage point, knowing as much as I know now about the regime, that would even be possible. Mm-hmm. But that would be another thing. What I object to and what overshadows, frankly, a lot of the good that this administration might otherwise have done is this sane, erratic, unpredictable, over-the-top rhetoric, a zigzag. If you can figure out what our policy was or is on Syria, you're a better reporter than
I was in our newsroom the day that he was at that rally, and he said, and we're going to be getting out of Syria very soon, a couple weeks ago. And in the newsroom, a number of people who know more about Syria than I do looked up at the TVs and said, what, we're in Syria? Like, what's going on? What are we even talking about? And then it was days of trying to figure out what he was talking about, in fact, that he wasn't really talking about a set policy thing. It seemed like he was just sort of off on a tangent, but then trying to figure out policy to accord with that, and that we do see that happen over and over again with the National Guard being deployed to the border. It seems like in part because he saw some pieces on Fox News that riled him up, and so we have some troops that are deployed because of that, and that becomes policy. He's the president. Whatever he wants to make happen has a good chance of becoming the policy.
This is the danger of Donald Trump. He has been a BSer his entire life, and now when he does it, it has real-life consequences. And because he has not chosen to inform himself of the issues of the day or the world around him, it often bears no resemblance whatsoever to reality. And he says things and does things for effect or because he wants to impress or he wants to make himself look good or he wants to reassure his base or he wants them to say nice things about him on Fox News. And I think the bill is coming due on a lot of this. I think you can't run a superpower in this fashion and not get yourself into real trouble at some point. And frankly, I think Bashar al-Assad did what he did in part because Donald Trump said he's out of there and he disclaimed any interest in Syria. Assad feels no restraints at this point because he has a president who's so fickle. Now, maybe that's a wrong assessment, but you can understand how foreign leaders do assess those things.
Last year we had the, was it 59 missiles that the Trump ordered in the strike after the attacks then?
And then it was like, that
nothing.
Was the end of the Syria discussion. And now it comes back up and we try to figure out what to do about it. But look, I don't know that anybody knows a great answer to Syria. And not everything is Obama versus Trump, but certainly with the Obama folks, they know that that's probably going to be the thing that goes down as the biggest black mark against him, certainly on the global stage, because he could not figure out what to do and didn't really want to figure out what to do. And then sort of left that to the next president, whoever the next president was going to be. In this case, it's Donald Trump.
And in that regard, I would completely agree with him. It was a solvable problem then. There are no solvable real solutions now.
Trump in 2015 called you a low IQ person. He tweeted about you. What happens when Donald Trump tweets about you?
Oh, I get a lot of followers on Twitter. I sort of wish he'd do it again. He hasn't done it in a while. You know, you get a lot of new Twitter followers. You get this deluge of hate emails and hate postings and hate tweets. And it's just indicative. It's fascinating, actually, to watch it play out because he is able to so rile up the mob based upon nothing at all to isolate a adversary in such fashion that it's both impressive and frightful.
What is it? I have found that what women get in terms of hate emails and tweets is always much more intense than what men get.
Yes.
Is it that kind of thing? Like I have female colleagues get like someone should rape you and someone should kill you. I don't get someone should kill you. I don't get someone should rape you. President Trump has never tweeted about me, but I do get my share of things like that. Is it that?
Or yes. Some of it is really terribly disturbing and terribly vulgar and anti-Semitic. So if it doesn't mention the fact that I'm Jewish, it will certainly attack me on some aspect of my physiology because I'm a woman. Mm-hmm. And I have come to believe, and I don't say this lightly, that we do have a mental health problem in this country, that there are a lot of lonely, angry people who really, you know, have some warped views of things. I don't think they're necessarily dangerous, but they're really out there.
There are stories that other people have done and looked into, like where they confront their Twitter trolls, and there are times where these people end up being perfectly nice people who have this, like, this is the way that they like vent off all the anger that's in them. But it does come out. I get emails sometimes from people. I think, how would you even sit down to write that email?
Yes. Why would you spend the time to do it? You know, I caught one that you are evil. You speak with the serpent's tongue. I mean, it went on and on and on in that vein. And my philosophy on this is I don't engage at all with those.
You'll
I am so busy. I am so busy. And I do try to acknowledge, even if it's just a thanks exclamation mark, the nice comments that people send in. I don't have time.
No thanks exclamation mark to speaking with the serpent's tongue.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, I used to say when I had a little bit more time that I'm sorry you're so angry, I'll pray for you. But I don't even have that time at this point. So
because you're getting so many hateful
yes.
tweets. Let's end here. You were someone who, a fan of Mitt Romney. You've written about him in all sorts of different ways. He's running for Senate this year. He kicked off his Senate candidacy with a moment that struck a lot of people, which was that President Trump tweeted about him endorsing him, and he tweeted back, thanks for the endorsement. I'm proud to get it. He had said, talking about accepting Trump's endorsement for president in 2012, in 2016, he had said, I wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't, and if I were running now, I wouldn't take it. What do you make of Mitt Romney? What's going on?
Well, he's a politician, to put it mildly. And the way I read that was a little different than other people. I read it as putting out the bare minimum he needed so that he wasn't rude.
But he accepted the endorsement.
But he accepted it.
Which he said he wouldn't do.
Which he said he wouldn't. So listen, he's not a model of consistency. Many politicians are not. I perhaps have come to the point where I'm more lenient with the normal political faults of politicians, of being blowhards, of being vain, of being somewhat hypocritical. If, as I look at them as a human being and as a political servant, they're decent people who understand the severe challenge we face right now. So I didn't like it. And I actually thought his announcement was very good. He ignored Trump entirely. Mm-hmm. The little video he did was quintessential Mitt Romney, kind of technocrat. We're going to fix these things. We know how to do it. I'm the guy to do it. That's Mitt Romney.
He's the odds-on favorite to win. He's running as a Republican in Utah. There is a Democratic candidate who's running a spirited race, but with where voter trends are, most people would be surprised if he didn't win. So if we have Senator Mitt Romney there in the Senate next January, what do you think we should expect of him? Is he going to be the leader of the anti-Trump movement? Is he going to be the guy who says thanks for the endorsement, who does the sort of – who walks the same path that Paul Ryan ultimately did?
I think people are wrong to expect that he would oppose him on things like taxes or – other conservative principles. Which
Jeff Flake said to me, I asked him a couple months ago, well, so you, but you voted for all this stuff. He said, look, I don't like Donald Trump. I've made that very clear, but I still have the beliefs that I had, and they are these. So he said, I don't know why people think that I'm going to vote against things that I believe in.
Right. I think the real question is when push comes to shove, when Trump, God forbid, fires the special prosecutor or fires the deputy attorney general, or the report comes out and it's devastating, what does he do then? And I think I would hope that at that point he understands and reflects back on what he said during the campaign, that there are some
Mitt Romney thinks that
there are some things that do go beyond politics, and that he's there for a purpose, and his purpose is not to act as Donald Trump's defensive or I guess offensive line, protecting the quarterback. And I would hope that he would do the right thing, be outspoken, defend American institutions, defend the rule of law. Am I super duper confident that that's the way he goes? I have very low expectations at this point of Republicans. I would hope so. But I think, first of all, there is some chance he will be in the minority at that point, which would be very interesting. And then he becomes a perhaps influential vote as a swing member to get a majority vote or to get to 60 on certain topics.
Yeah, I mean, whether the Republicans or Democrats in the majority, and the fact that we're even talking about that as a question is a real – it does show how crazy our politics are right now and how much the Republicans have squandered what was historically large numbers, not historically large in the Senate, but to have the Senate by that number and the House and by certainly the House.
Governors and state legislatures.
And electing a Republican president to where we are, where like we're legitimately talking about the possibility that Democrats could win the House and maybe even the Senate is nuts.
Yes. And it's really for totally different reasons, the flip side of obviously what the Democrats experienced in the first midterm that they went through.
Yeah, and what beyond the flip side of what they expected was going to happen if Hillary Clinton had won, then the devastation of 2018 that every Democrat assumed was going to happen and now – and didn't think there was much of a chance of happening for the Republicans in 18, but – here we are. We'll see what happens.
That was the great miscalculation, wasn't it? That Paul Ryan thought he was going to lose, so it would be okay just to be the loyal soldier. And then he woke up and said, oh my God, this guy is now president. Oh, I can get tax reform. And off they went.
All right, Jennifer Rubin, thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure.
So we'll know in a few months whether Mitt Romney does get to the Senate and what he does from that. But we may not wait until then to know what he has to say about Bob Mueller and Rod Rosenstein and what President Trump may decide to do about them. Thanks, as always, to Zach Stanton for producing. Remember to subscribe. Seth Meyers, Mayor Michael Tubbs, and more coming. And follow me on Twitter @IsaacDover. And catch you next time on Off Message.